I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. Nam Lee joins me now. He was born in Vietnam and raised in Australia. He joins me from here in Vancouver. He is the author of a new book, The Boat. It has been described by Kirkus Review as a polished and intense debut story collection of astonishing range, and that it is. There are 7 stories in here that take the reader from the slums of Colombia to Tehran to Iowa City to Australia, the South China Sea, and New York City. They're powerful stories that speak to the reader. The Boat is published by Bond Street Books, an imprint of Doubleday, and retails for $27.95. He's also the fiction editor of the Harvard Review. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Nam Lee. Good morning, Mr. Lee.
Good morning, Jay. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. You were once a corporate lawyer.
I was.
Why did you quit that profession?
Why didn't I more early is probably the more apt question. I just didn't, you know, there's a lot of stuff that I did enjoy about it, and it's, you know, I found it intellectually stimulating, and just the sort of discipline that I required, you know, both in my life and in my work, was probably something which was good for me. But in the end, it just wasn't for me. I really didn't like, you know, putting on the suit in the morning. I didn't like having to work under other people. I didn't like, you know, doing work and exerting myself in, you know, pretty substantial ways for an end product which didn't, to me, seem that worthwhile.
It seems to relate to a story that's in the book. Did you go into the profession because of perhaps pressure from your parents?
You know, I think that's probably, that was one of the factors, but it certainly wouldn't have been the determining factor. I think, certainly in Australia back then, where we, it's changing now, but back then you could do law as an undergraduate degree, and pretty much everyone I knew did arts and law or common law, did some sort of combined degree, and it would have seemed, certainly to me, extraordinarily slack to just do an arts degree, because as it was with arts and law, I was only at university 12 hours a week with, you know, contact hours.
Well, what's the earliest you can remember writing?
I don't really know how to answer that question. I was always reading and was always, you know, scribbling this or that, mostly in response to what I was reading. Sort of designating yourself a writer is a really tricky thing, and, you know, it's a sort of loaded term, and so I sort of avoid it when I can. I like to think of myself as, you know, someone who writes, but I think writing is something you do, or a writer is something you are by virtue and by mere virtue of the fact that you write, you know, and there aren't really that many sort of normative judgments which go into it. So I would sort of facetiously answer your question by saying I was always a writer, and I'm not writing enough.
Why did your parents leave Vietnam?
We were boat people. We were refugees from the Vietnam War. My dad had fought in the war in the South Vietnamese Army and had been incarcerated for 3 years in what they called, you know, euphemistically re-education camps. And so once he got out of there, he was pretty adamant that he wanted his family to get out of the country.
The first story, and the title is Love and Honor and Pity and Pride and Compassion and Sacrifice.
Right.
How autobiographical is it?
It's very, very much a fiction. It certainly takes a lot of autobiographical incidents and experiences, and then it sort of plays with the idea of how fiction plays with nonfiction, and it does it pretty openly. As you know, the main character, the protagonist, is named Nam, like me, and he, you know, used to be a lawyer, and he's now in Iowa City, where I was for 2 years. But a lot of how the story moves, a lot of the engine that drives the plot of the story, and a lot of the sort of incidents that were described in that story never happened at all. It was very much a contrivance.
And you never experimented with crystal meth?
You know, obviously not. I would never do anything even remotely illicit, Joe.
Yeah. In terms of your identity, how do you react to that? I mean, do you? It's easy when you talk to press people or people that make up the book jackets to your books.
Right.
They refer to you as either Vietnamese or Australian.
Right.
Are you now American?
Yeah, I tend to be called American when someone is about to criticize me. I think I'm currently living in the UK, and you know that's something I've noticed is, you know, I'm American when I need to be a steel target, and I'm Vietnamese when someone has, you know, perhaps an ethnic prism through which they want to read or view the stories. And, you know, I'm Australian, you know, when I'm back home in Australia, obviously. It's just one of those things that to me seems, you know, incredibly material and pertinent on a personal level, you know, how you identify yourself, which sort of constituencies you figure yourself as belonging to. But at the same time, you know, as a writer, I sometimes find it, you know, the last thing that should be on a reader's mind. You know, I would like to hope that the words on the page are the main thing on which the work is being judged, and particularly in this collection of stories, which take place, as you mentioned, you know, all over the world and from different points of view, it just doesn't seem, you know, all that instructive to me to come to it or to tell readers to come to it, having the fact that the author is a Vietnamese Australian or Vietnamese Australian American or, you know, American or UK citizen or anything like that. It just seems like another bit of noise.
Does it matter where you write? Because I read that you'd left Australia and you went to Iowa.
Right.
One would read that and think that you couldn't write in Australia.
Oh, no. The reason why I left Australia to go to Iowa was because I was undertaking a master's course in Iowa City, Iowa.
This is the Iowa Writers' Workshop?
That's right, yeah. And so that's the only reason I chose there. To be honest, I really didn't know anything about Iowa at all before I went there, and so it was purely the opportunity that brought me there. I guess it does matter to me where I write, but I'm really not sure how to pass that, to tell you the truth. I know there are certain places that feel more charged and full of possibility for me, but oftentimes it's not, you know, the geographical place or the geopolitical place. It's just that sort of sense and mood and sometimes climate and light, you know, all these sorts of things play into how you configure yourselves and how you sort of summon that voodoo that you need to sit down and write.
When you're on tour like you are now, do you find that you can write?
I cannot write, no, when I'm on tour. That's one of the things that makes the promotional side of things, you know, more equivocal than it otherwise might be, because I'm not very good with concentrating on more than one thing at a time, and this is pretty much a writing dead zone whenever I'm doing this stuff.
But do you think of ideas? Do ideas come to you, perhaps?
Sometimes they do, and one of the great perks is, you know, the conversations that you get to have with other writers, and you meet new writers, and you're exposed to their work and their new ideas, and often that really, I mean, just yesterday I was having a conversation with a writer, and it really tweaks some structural ideas for my next project.
Talk to me about Iowa. You met Frank Conroy there?
I did, yes. I worked under him, and actually I was a student in his very last full workshop.
What did he mean to you?
He meant a lot to me. He was the guiding sensibility that, first of all, you know, picked me out of the application pile and sort of saw something in my submission, which I've subsequently, you know, came from a novel which I subsequently ditched. And he, you know, it sounds sort of corny to say so, but he believed in my work, and that's not to say that he wasn't tough on it. I mean, I think I sought him out when I was at Iowa because he was renowned for his tough love approach. He could be quite critical of the work that was in front of him, and my work was certainly no exception to that. But it just felt as though there was that unconditional support. There was a sort of calmness about his confidence in my work, which really has kept me in good stead. And did, certainly through those 2 years in Iowa.
I want to go back to the first story, because I'm still thinking about it after reading it.
Oh, cheers, Joe.
In terms of the character in that story, Nam, he's at a cocktail party or something like that, where he's talking to other writers, or his friends, I guess.
Sure.
And they say to him that he should exploit or mine his own heritage for material.
Right.
Was that a fear on your part to not do that? Like, that's clumsy, but did you not want to do that initially?
You know, I've sort of veered from take to take and perspective to perspective on this matter. I know that when I was first starting out, I was very, very conscious of the fact that not so much that there was writing that was, you know, perhaps ethnically directed or oriented, because I think, you know, writers come to their material in different ways, and certainly your own experience, your own background, your own heritage is invaluable and sometimes, you know, absolutely essential and unavoidable in coming to your material. But what I really resisted, I think, was the idea that there was an entire infrastructure built around, and it was a marketing infrastructure, it was a commercial infrastructure that was built around, you know, taking these so-called ethnic stories and ethnic literature and packaging them in some ways for consumption by, you know, by the mainstream reader, the mainstream white Western reader. And I sort of have always held a very idealistic and naive and romantic view of letters, whereby I like to believe that the primary and ideally, you know, the sole consideration should be how good the work is on the page. And I fully understand that obviously there are so many external factors and there are so many, you know, collateral considerations which come into how a writer brings something alive to the page and then how a reader sort of interchanges and reacts to that stuff. But I do believe that this infrastructure that was sort of built up around, you know, not just ethnic literature, but, you know, all of the sort of genres of literature and, you know, all of the ways in which shelves in bookstores are now sort of sequestered from one another and demarcated as though you're walking into a supermarket. You know, these things were things that were playing on my mind. So I was very conscious of not wanting to be pigeonholed. I was very conscious of, you know, wanting to be able to write about my ethnic past as I have in this book, but also wanting to be able to write about pretty much anything I wanted, you know, anything that moved or inspired me. And I found that not only was it difficult as a disadvantage to being pigeonholed, but it was also difficult because oftentimes there was a sense that it advantaged people. It advantaged people. It was some sort of affirmative action that was going on in the book industry. And that really rubbed me up the wrong way as well. I wanted neither to be advantaged or disadvantaged by virtue of my ethnicity or where I came from or what my name was. And so these are the sort of considerations. It's not as simple as, you know, wanting to go one way or the other, but it was just wanting to do justice to the complexity of these issues.
The Nam in the first story has to deal with his father visiting him, and right. we soon learn about their relationship, and I guess the relationship that all sons have with their fathers.
Right.
That we never escape them, that we seem to that their sacrifices are our responsibilities.
Right.
Talk to me about that and what that idea means to you, I guess. Do you find that there is a pressure on you that seems to never escape you?
I think that's maybe one of the defining questions of certainly how we think of ourselves as maturing or becoming fully adult. Is we find ourselves in a position where we might have to take responsibility for circumstances and things that we had no control over. You know, you have no control over which family you're born into. You have no control over how your parents sacrificed or worked or moved in order to enable your life. You had no choice or say or volition over any of that. You know, you have no control over what ethnicity or what background you come from, the experiences you have in your childhood, and, you know, the cultural sort of matrix within which you're enmeshed. And you can resist against those things, and I think all of us do to some extent, but there comes a time when we find that we have to be accountable for these things which weren't a result of our own choices. And I think that's really one of the interesting things. I mean, is it what you have no control over which defines you, or is it what you know, purposefully choose? And I think there's such an interesting transaction between those two worlds. And I think that's one of those things that I think you're right. You know, we are continually coming to terms with what our parents do, have done for us, who our parents are, thinking of our parents not just as our parents, but as sons and daughters and sisters and brothers and uncles and aunts and in various capacities as human beings. And so I think that's one of those things that, you know, you feel yourself continually pulled in to a system and pulled into a web of relationships and dynamics and cultures and social understandings, which have been determined for you from the get-go. And at the same time, you're trying to define who you are, and you're trying to define what it is about you that's intrinsic and innate what it is about you that could only have been about you no matter where you were born or how you were brought up. And I think that's the tension which I find most interesting, especially to be played out in fiction.
You're not much older than I am.
Right.
A couple years older than I am. Do we ever come to terms with it? Do we ever understand each other better, do you think?
You know, I think it's... I sort of fall back on paradox in cases like this. You know, I think from one point of view, we can never know another human being. We can really never get inside their head, inside their skin, and understand what it is about them that makes them who they are. We can never really even unpack an action, I think, you know, and attribute one motivation to why people do things. We can never really know why people do what they do. And at the same time, I feel as though that's the human project. That's the fundamental, the primary enterprise, is to try to reach out, try to connect, try to find common ground, and not just between, you know, ourselves and our friends and family, but between ourselves and the person on the other side of the world. And so that's why I think, you know, fiction is a really useful instrument, because it can get that sense of mystery and unknowability across about another person. But the only way it does that is by employing a set of common signals and symbols and languages, I guess, in order to communicate what is, you know, to use, again, a corny term, what is universal. I don't think we ever get to really know, but I think that it's the continually trying and failing and trying again that makes us human, I guess.
Have your parents read your book?
My dad has read my book, and I just gave my mum a, you know, she was waiting for a signed copy from me before she would read it. And, you know, I sort of took ages to figure out how best to inscribe the book to her. So I think she's probably, you know, going through it at the moment.
I'm interested, are short story collections, do they sell well? Are they popular?
I think it's pretty much fair to say they do not sell well, and they're commercially very unpopular. I know I've heard a lot of stories, you know, having gone through this experience about, you know, bookstores that otherwise are fierce champions of fiction, or, you know, readers who love fiction, but as soon as they're told that a book is a book of short stories, it puts them off. And so it's always a commercial challenge, I think.
How do you write? Do you write longhand? Do you write on a computer?
I mainly write on a computer. I'll often take notes and sort of scribble things down in a notebook and then transcribe them at some point, but mainly it's word processing.
And how much research do you do, or do you do any at all?
I do a lot of research. You know, often I'll fall into research as a way of not writing and as a way of procrastinating. But, you know, particularly with the stories that are in this book, where, you know, some of them take place in places I've never been, you know, I'm very wary of needing to, you know, accumulate the knowledge and the authority, I guess, to really get the narrative going. So I try to get my hands on pretty much everything I can, you know, books and magazines and photos and talk to people, you know, anything I can.
Have you ever written about lesbian vampires?
I have, actually, yeah.
And will we see that one day, or?
The story is, you know, in an advanced draft, but I still don't feel as though it's quite there. It doesn't have that extra something. You know, you'd think that just being about lesbian vampires might be enough, but in this case, it's missing something. So I'm not sure. If I ever revisit it, then perhaps I'll handball it to the wider world.
It's mentioned in the first story, and so you expect to see it. And
I guess I'm sorry to have disappointed you.
There's a little bit of disappointment, I must say. Yeah. I don't know if I mentioned this, but I alluded to it. You are 29, are you?
I'm actually 30 now.
You're 30
just
already.
30 last week, I think.
Well, happy birthday.
Cheers.
And what do you say to when people say that yours is a voice so wise and perceptive for your years? How do you react to that?
You know, with gratitude and you know, self-directed skepticism, I guess. I think it's you know, wisdom and profundity are two sort of characterizations that, you know, when you actually try to break them down and figure out what they consist of, you know, no one can really say. It's like one of those, it's like that Justice Potter Stewart line, you know, you don't know what pornography is. I don't know how to define it, but you know it when you see it,
right,
in a certain sense. And to me, I guess what people, what I take people to be referring to when they talk about, you know, wisdom in writing, is just a close and careful attention. You know, and I try to to pay attention as much as I can, and I try to pay attention to character and to plot, to the language, to the structure of how something works, to how a scene is put together. And I try not to take the path of least resistance when I'm in that process. And I don't really think that's wisdom on my part at all, but I think what it is trying as much to be attentive and open to the wisdom that's actually in the text itself, that's actually in the experience, because I think that sort of resides in all of our experiences.
Do you read a lot?
I do.
More so than, say, the average person?
I would say yes, yeah.
And how do you find that affects your writing? I mean, they obviously go together, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, I actually was talking to a good friend of mine who's a writer. He was asked about, how his reading life and writing life affect one another. And, I really liked his answer. He said that he thinks of them as the same thing. It's the same element that you swim in when you're reading and writing. Of course, it's very different muscles that are being exercised. But, I don't know any writer, I don't know any serious writer who's not also, by definition, a very serious reader.
Do you also watch television?
I do, yes.
Whenever I have writers on, I ask them about that, because some writers tend to look down on TV.
Right, right. I thought about this a fair bit, and I think a lot of TV does a lot of things that, frankly, a lot of writers could learn a lot of things from. I was asked about watching a network show, not even a cable show, and thinking about it in terms of structure, because I thought it was quite amazing that we think of TV as being geared toward, the lowest common denominator in terms of audience. And yet, I was watching Friday Night Lights, and just the pilot of it was so deftly done and so sophisticated in that it pretty much started, I was counting, something like 20 or 25 narrative strands or strands of tension or character dynamic that were then played out through the rest of the season. But it did it so deftly and with such sure and confident shorthand that you watched it and were totally drawn in and were feeling empathy for all of these different characters and beginning to understand some of the racial tensions, some of the class tensions, of the storyline. And that was something which, when you read most literary fiction, it's much more limited in its structural scope and its perspectival scope. And so I thought, if we look down on TV, then in a sense we're disavowing ourselves of the remarkable scope that people out there have when it comes to retaining, narrative strands in their mind, when it comes to bringing a very complex configuration of plot to a set of circumstances, narrative circumstances. And so, I really respect TV for that. I mean, I do think that fiction goes deeper when it's good. I think that fiction manages to stay alive to the contradictions and complexities, and I think the TV is in many ways dealing with a certain shorthand, but that's not to say that I look down on it at all.
Did you read Friday Night Lights?
I don't know. I didn't read it, no. I don't know. I've only watched it.
Yeah, do you think that it was good on TV because it was a book previously?
I don't know how to answer that question because I haven't read it.
Yeah. Well, is it something that you would pick up, perhaps, or watch the movie, maybe?
I have watched the movie, and I've just watched the first season of the television show, but I haven't. I've been told by friends that the second season goes a bit downhill, so I don't know whether I'd pick up that DVD. And I'm not really sure, to tell you the truth, whether I'd pick up the book, because it's the to be read pile next to my metaphorical bed is getting pretty tall.
I'll bet, yeah. Well, this has been on my pile, and I've been reading it, and it's a wonderful collection. Congratulations on it, and continued good luck with the boat.
Oh, cheers, Joe. It really means a lot to me. Thank you.
Thank you. The book is called The Boat, $27.95. Bond Street Books is its publisher. It's an imprint of Doubleday. For the commentary, I'm Joseph Lunner.